Welcome back to the program. Over the past week or two, we have spent time here talking about the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, talking about the impact of Ronald Reagan in bringing about the end of the Cold War. We're going to look at it in a little broader context this morning as we talk about the 80s in general, more specifically the influence that Ronald Reagan had on that period. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Gil Troy. He's a professor of history at McGill University. He's the author of the previous book, Leading from the Center, Why Moderates Make the Best Presidents. He's the author of two new books about this period of time. One, he's the editor of a volume called Living in the 80s, and the author of a new book called The Reagan Revolution, A Very Short Introduction. Gil Troy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. To what extent do you think that Ronald Reagan, more than in a political context, but in a social and cultural context, influenced the 80s?
There are some presidents who define their times. Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. Bill Clinton, you could argue, in the 1990s. But certainly Ronald Reagan, not just in the 1980s, but since then, I think was really in many ways the defining figure of post-World War II American history. And you're right, it wasn't just political. It was social, it was cultural, economic. He really captured the moment. And it's not that he caused everything, but that his song, his poetry, his imagery helped shape our understanding of the times.
To what extent was that the influence of Reagan on the times, or the times reflected through Reagan and his election as president?
This is one of the central tensions we historians struggle with, you know, the man versus the moment, or the person and the period. And I think with Reagan, the way I get around that is I say that he invented the 1980s, meaning that there were certainly issues that were emerging beforehand. There were forces that were transforming the country beforehand. But he was able to shape it by giving basically a narrative of America having been beaten down in the 60s and the 70s and now coming back. Morning in America was his 1984 presidential campaign, and emphasizing a return of pride, a return of patriotism, a return of capitalism, a return of optimism. And those are many of the themes that emerged not only in the 80s, but subsequently.
It's interesting when looking at this period of time, the Reagan presidency, to look back at Reagan's time as governor of California and see the sort of shoots that were rising at that time in California that kind of set the stage for Reagan and some of these issues that you're talking about.
You know, everybody dismissed Reagan as a mere actor, and they said, oh, you know, he came to the presidency so inexperienced. And he would often point out that he had been governor of California, which was, a huge state at the time and still is, and had a serious economy, and that he had really learned. And in some ways, he didn't mind being underestimated because he thought that it made his political opponent sloppy. But absolutely, during his time in the 1960s and 70s as a governor of California, he was involved in a lot of what we now call the culture wars. He was involved in fights over cutting the budget. The truth is that as governor, he often ended up raising taxes despite his attempts. And also as governor, who was actually much more of a social activist, he got much more involved in social-cultural conflict that by the time he was president, he was trying to avoid.
To what extent did Reagan embody 15 years later, what Richard Nixon used to talk about as the silent majority?
Ronald Reagan felt that he was not only reflecting the silent majority, but he was giving them a voice, and that he was reflecting their frustrations and their angers and turning them into hope. I mean, one of the things that's extraordinary about Ronald Reagan and what he did to conservatism was, if you remember Barry Goldwater from the 1960s, mm-hmm. His conservatism was cranky. And what Ronald Reagan was able to do was put a smiley face, a happy face, a song of hope on conservatism, and generally show not just conservatives but also Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, subsequent politicians, the importance of giving Americans a sense of hope, a sense of optimism. And, of course, this is not only after the traumas of the 1960s but after the sour, pinched days of Jimmy Carter in the 1970s, Ronald Reagan said, no, well, that's not us, that's not Americans, we are forward-thinking, we want to be happy.
But yet Ronald Reagan's conservatism was a different kind of conservatism, a kind of anti-intellectual conservatism, very different from the conservatism that Barry Goldwater personified and the ideas of people like Bill Rusher and Bill Buckley and many others at the time.
Reagan was a populist, and while Reagan had a good and long friendship with William Buckley and others, and thought of himself much more as a thinker than people gave him credit for, he definitely was playing to the crowds, and he was trying to shape a conservatism that would work. And, you know, the core of his conservatism was his anti-communism. It really started in many ways in the 1940s when he was working in Hollywood and he saw the pernicious influence of the communists back there, and he saw the Soviet Union as the source of the major evil in the world. He believed that it would topple, and everybody thought he was nuts. And it's important to point out that at the beginning of the 1980s, when a Ronald Reagan, a Margaret Thatcher, a Pope John Paul talked about ending communism, talked about the weaknesses in communism, people thought that they were lunatics, and how things have changed. And that was really the start of his conservatism, and that did shape a certain kind of anti-intellectual conservatism, because he saw intellectuals as all too often being on the left and being too soft on communism.
To what extent did Reagan's success come in part from the fact that the liberal movement at the time, which had been going on really since the early to the mid-60s, and all the changes and all the social and cultural ferment that was coming along, by the time Reagan came along in 1980, was out of steam? This movement had been going strong for 15 years and was kind of out of ideas and out of energy at that point.
There was a famous campaign commercial that the Republicans ran in the 1980s, a sort of generic commercial, not about Reagan, about a big, fat, white-haired Democrat who looked like the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, literally driving a car that runs out of gas. And that was one of the metaphors that the Republicans used for what they called the Reagan Revolution. And they were saying that the Great Society failed. And, you know, there was great disappointment. There was, you know, so much hope that the civil rights laws, the welfare legislation, would lead to an era of paradise. And instead what people saw was growing crime, growing racial conflict, riots. And Reagan was able to say, well, that's because we forgot who we were. We relied too much on government and not enough on ourselves. And at the moment, in 1980, that worked in the same way that, you know, today people are saying, well, maybe we've gone too far to focusing on the individual and forgotten the role of the important role government can play.
And of course, what was helpful to Reagan in getting elected was the abject failure of the Carter presidency.
Jimmy Carter invented Ronald Reagan in many ways. Ronald Reagan was clever enough when he won in 1980 to talk about the mandate, and people talked about the Reagan mandate. But when you look closely at it, you realize that it really was what I call an ABC election, anybody but Carter. Ronald Reagan came in, and Ronald Reagan's optimism plays off of Jimmy Carter's pessimism. Ronald Reagan's prosperity is a response to the inflation that Jimmy Carter was unable to control. Ronald Reagan's aggressive stance against what he called the evil empire, and when he called the Soviet Union the evil empire in 1983, again, people said, wow, you can't do that. They're going to get angry with us. That kind of moralistic approach to foreign policy was a response to Jimmy Carter's much more weak, much more I'm okay, you're okay, kumbaya approach that Reagan said ended up with hostages in Iran and the general weakness of America throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that the Reagan presidency did over time is it gave new life, it breathed new life into the opposition, into the cultural and social and political forces that existed in opposition to Reagan, forces which, as you indicated before, had kind of run out of steam.
When Ronald Reagan comes into office, the Democrats at first are flummoxed. And for the first 9, 10, 11 months, they just don't know what to do. They just can't get any traction in the same way that today the Republicans have not quite been able to get any traction with Barack Obama. And it takes the first congressional recess, when congressmen go home in the summer of 1981 and they start seeing the effects of what they start calling the Reagan recession, and they start seeing what they call the fairness issues, that the Democrats finally start gaining some steam. And so you're absolutely right that it took them a while to find their voice, but Reagan helped give them a voice. And more broadly, I think what we see in the 1980s, when we compare the Democratic Party in the 1980s to the Democratic Party in the 1990s, the Democratic Party in the 1980s is much more idealistic, much more ideological. It finds its voice, it finds its soul, reflected in the powerful words of Mario Cuomo, the powerful words of Ted Kennedy. And in the 1990s, when it has to sort of rationalize things that Bill Clinton does, it sort of loses its way.
And why is that, do you think? Why does it lose its way? And does it lose its way because it tries to be too homogenized?
I think one of the reasons why it loses its way is, you know, there's a funny thing about power. The old cliche that power corrupts, there's a certain truth to it. So what happens is, especially with the partisanship that's emerged in America in the last 20, 30 years, that Democrats couldn't, in some ways, and Republicans are equally guilty of this, this is not a partisan statement, but both Democrats and Republicans sort of lost their intellectual consistency, and what we see in the 1990s is Democrats are so angry at the Republicans and so committed to keeping Bill Clinton in office that they'll override core principles like the feminist idea of not having sexual harassment in the White House in order to keep him in power. And so that was one of the things that was going on. And the second thing that you're mentioning is that Bill Clinton himself sort of confused the Democratic Party with his post-Reagan approach, where he was the one, not Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton was the one who said the era of big government is over. Bill Clinton was the one who tried to create more of a centrist Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party in some ways lost its vision.
Although it's so interesting to look at the conservatism of Reagan through the lens of today, and arguably those that are that call themselves conservatives today would probably find Ronald Reagan too liberal.
Ronald Reagan was actually often criticized by conservatives back when he was in office. Almost from the start, I found in the Reagan Library within a month of Reagan's taking office, complaints by conservatives that he was being too accommodating, he was being too centrist. I argue that the reason why Ronald Reagan worked as a president was because while he came from the conservative wing of the Republican Party, he understood that he was not the president of the conservatives, and he was not the president of the Republicans, he was the president of the United States of America. And he was frequently playing to the center, and that ability to play to the center while still having conservative bona fides is what made him so effective.
That desire to play to the center, did that come from Reagan, or did that come from the people around him?
It's a good question. It's hard to tell exactly how much influence the people around him had, how much influence Reagan himself had. Clearly, when he had an excellent team around him in the first term with James Baker, Ed Meese, and Michael Deaver working together, he was much more effective than in the second term when he had Don Regan and a much more divided White House. So clearly the three of those people, and there was a dynamic between Meese, who was more the right-wing radical, Baker, who was a sort of the rock-ribbed conservative patriarch, and Deaver, who was the image man, they sort of averaged together and created Reagan's genius. And that was part of it. But the other part of it was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan did not like to be pushed around, and Ronald Reagan didn't like all the talk that he was just the marionette being manipulated by the puppeteers. And he had a vision, and part of his vision was a conservative vision, an anti-communist vision, but part of that vision also was being president of all the people and doing it in a way that succeeded. And he was very sensitive to public opinion polls on many issues, and he wanted to find that center. He wanted to be the president of all the people because ultimately he learned from Franklin Roosevelt. He grew up in the 1930s. He came to maturity in the 1930s, and he saw Roosevelt's ability to use radio to unite the people, to push the people to a whole other level, as something that he wanted to do via television, and he did.
And yet it was during the Reagan presidency that was born the culture wars that we see today. I mean, those wars may have gestated in the period before Reagan, but they really were given light during the Reagan years.
Yes, Reagan, and it's interesting because Reagan himself tried to dodge the culture wars in many ways, less so when he was governor of California, but when he was president, he actually frustrated the conservatives by not focusing on their ABCs of abortion, busing, and crime. Nevertheless, the people he brought into office, a secretary of education like William Bennett, the voice that he gave to conservatives was one of the things that precipitated this culture war that in many ways continues to divide America. And it was both constructive and destructive. It was constructive in that I think in the wake of the 1960s, what Ronald Reagan was trying to do was get people thinking about some of the changes that had gone on, some of the inability to keep family ties, the selfishness, and he wanted people to really reject some of those trends. But on the other hand, what was destructive about it was that Reagan himself was pretty hypocritical on many of these issues. He lived a much more quote-unquote liberal or libertarian lifestyle than his rhetoric suggested. But more than that was that a lot of it played out in the harshest, most hysterical ways. So, for example, on abortion, I think America evolved toward a consensus view on abortion where 60 to 70% of people in polls understand or believe that abortion is murder, but also that abortion needs to be legal. And yet the way it was played out again and again was either pro-choice or pro-life. So you had partisans on both sides playing this polarizing battle, while most Americans sort of had a much more live-and-let-live opinion of, well, you know, we don't like it, but we understand that sometimes people have to resort to this kind of these kind of necessities. And so that was one of the things that's also going on in the 1980s and in the collection that I just came out with, Living in the 80s. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you see is you see very different voices, you know, sometimes talking about the culture war, sometimes talking about the economic tensions. In Living in the 80s, we have liberal writers, we have conservative writers, but all of them are looking at the 80s in a way that's just much more multidimensional and much more complex and saying, yes, there were these culture wars, what did it mean and what was going on there?
One of the failures, arguably, and in this collection, Living in the 80s, David Greenberg's piece talking about the Democratic Party during the out years, and I would argue its failure to be creative enough in ways to address kind of modernity within the context of the 80s. Talk a little about that.
You know, the Democrats had an easy answer to their failure. They said, well, you know, Ronald Reagan is such a genius at communication. He's such a superstar. It's all about style. You see this most effectively most dramatically in the 1984 Walter Mondale Ronald Reagan presidential campaign, where Mondale basically says, look, I'm not good on TV. And that's in some ways a loser's lament. What Greenberg essays talks about is that, in fact, what had to go on was that liberalism itself had to confront some of the excesses of the 60s, some of its failures in the Great Society, and come to a new plane, a new equilibrium, which ultimately with Barack Obama and a little bit with Bill Clinton, which acknowledged some of the weaknesses, some of the failures, some of the addiction to government, while also trying to continue to find a world and a communal message that's committed to social justice and that's committed to the us, not just the I.
Talk a little bit about some of the cultural shifts that were going on. Steven Greenberg, in his piece in Living in the 80s, talks a little about this.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Steven Greenberg talks about in his piece is the whole Michael Jackson phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
We forget that when Jackson, we can't say comes on the scene because he had been there for so long in the 1970s, but when he emerges really as a solo performer, the radio world has become once again very segregated. And Michael Jackson very cleverly teams up with Paul McCartney. He very cleverly markets, and he is able to cross over. And he's really has a huge role in creating a much more what we now call multicultural, multiracial radio market and culture, and especially in the wake of his death, it's worth sort of remembering that and seeing him as a historical phenomenon in the 1980s that was quite constructive beyond, you know, some of the other tragic trends that he was a part of as well.
Right, but it also was driven by the birth of MTV in 1981.
Right, and more broadly, you have this technological revolution where you have you have this huge shift from music being experienced just through the ear, through radio, and now all of a sudden being on television. And MTV has a huge role in, first of all, broadening the youth culture, in making it much more multicultural, multiracial, and also in making a huge difference in television. I mean, also the shift that goes on in the 1980s from that, what we used to call the three-network universe of ABC, mm-hmm. NBC, CBS. Now it's not only that we have Fox and a couple of other television channels, but we have this, you know, universe of 54 channels or 550 channels, and that's huge in terms of changing the social dynamics and changing the center, because it used to be that, you know, through Walter Cronkite you could speak to America. Now how do you speak to America when there are so many different voices?
Which brings up the broader issue of whether the influence of the Reagan period is as much about Reagan as it is about so much that was going on, so much that was transforming during that decade.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very hard when you're talking about a country of 220, 230 million at the time, now 300 million people, to unify a story, to sort of say, you know, to come up with a coherent storyline. And this is why we sort of use Ronald Reagan as historians to help us tell that story. But, you know, if you want to dial back and talk about the 1980s, you have to talk about the shock to the system in the 1970s and how companies like Microsoft mm-hmm. are emerging in the 1970s and only going to really emerge as powerhouses in the 1980s and 1990s. The whole computer revolution is going on. We see inventions of things, you mentioned MTV, but we see invention of things like, you know, the VCR, the microwave.
Mm-hmm.
They emerge in the 1980s, but their origins are in the 1970s. And so anytime, you know, we talk about an era and, you know, we name it either by its period, the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, or by a president, the Reagan era, the Roosevelt era, or simply give it a name like the Age of Ambiguity or the, the Age of Prosperity or the Gilded Age, we're oversimplifying. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, what are the essential elements that emerge? And when we step back, what sort of jumps out at us? And I think when we look at the 1980s, we see a period of prosperity. We see a period of peace. We see a period of patriotism. I call those the three P's of Ronald Reagan: peace, patriotism, and prosperity. But more than that, we also see an emerging materialism. One of the things that we have to talk about when we look at Ronald Reagan closely and his conservatism, his quote-unquote traditionalism, is that for all his talk about tradition, the capitalist consumerism that he embraced was absolutely undermining of tradition. It was extremely selfish and not collective. Mm. And one of the things that occurs during the Reagan era is a greater emergence of what I call the I rather than the us, an addiction not just to shopping and to the moment, but to the self. And that's very threatening to a democracy that relies on citizenship and needs a sense of collectivity. And I think when we look at the rise of Obama, we see that one of the things that was so effective in his 2004 speech was speaking about that, trying to figure out how do we recreate a sense of an us, a sense of a center, in this era with all our modern toys that keep us all in our little rooms.
Do you think that that shift from the I, from the us to I, that was defined in many ways during the Reagan years, that comes from Reagan himself, or does it come from the economy, his economic advisors, people around him, people that were influenced by the likes of Ayn Rand and others? What do you think is at the core of that change?
The cheap answer would be yes, you know, all of them. That, you know, it's many things going on, but there was, you know, we historians aren't allowed to use if examples, but I like to play the if game. And I say, you know, in 1976, Ronald Reagan almost won the presidency, and in many ways in 1980, Ronald Reagan almost lost the presidency. And if Ronald Reagan had emerged in 1976 with his rhetoric about individualism and Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman, I don't think he would have been the Reagan that he was in the 1980s. I think that the Great Inflation was so powerful in the late 70s that Ronald Reagan wouldn't have been able to defeat it. So he was lucky in that he came post-Carter as the inflation was starting to reduce. But what's also going on is that, you know, if Reagan had lost and Carter had come in, then we actually see that Carter wouldn't have been Reagan, and that Carter's pinched puritanical approach wouldn't have been as successful. And so what this thought exercise, I think, helps us realize is that, yes, Reagan didn't do it all, but Reagan was able to sort of ride the trends, and it was, you know, shifts in the economy. It was what was going on. The whole story of Wall Street has to be brought in, because Wall Street in the 1980s is at one of its peaks. Mm-hmm. The shifts going on in corporations, the shifts going on with technology. But what was so extraordinary about the 80s was that you had this person in the White House who was so effective at speaking to the American people and also branding this decade, putting his mark, like the old cattleman in the West, on the cow's hide, onto the sort of the collective hide of the country.
One of the ways in which Reagan embodied that from a public policy point of view was in this whole move towards privatization. And one of the early signs of that, one of the defining moments, arguably, of the Reagan presidency was what he did with the air traffic controllers.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan comes in, and he had actually had the support of PATCO, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, during the 1980 campaign. And when the air traffic controllers go on strike in the summer of 1981, Ronald Reagan draws a line in the sand and basically says, you're not allowed to strike against the federal government, and he breaks the union. And this is a very bold move. This is a very un-70s kind of move. This is a move that excited people around the world, especially because it worked. And Reagan took a huge risk. I mean, had there, God forbid, been a plane crash as a result of the air traffic controllers being fired, there would have been a very different story. But this became a huge moment, a huge leadership moment for Ronald Reagan, and part of a broader shift of breaking the unions. But the unions, in many ways, in the 1970s had been broken by their own corruption, by their own selfishness, by their own addiction to goodies rather than to the social good. And Reagan understood that. He knew that he was not taking on the unions that had supported Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. He was taking on the unions that had been in the pocket of Jimmy Carter in the 1970s. And so that's part of the story. And the bigger part of the story, and we also have an essay about that in Living in the 80s by Bruce Shulman, is this emergence of the private space, the emergence of shopping malls, which means that the public space is no longer Main Street, but is now a corporate-owned, corporate-controlled, homogenized environment. We have the rise of gated communities, which again means rather than it just being sort of a municipal space, a public space, we now have gates. Now, of course, not everybody's living in gated communities, not everybody's shopping in malls, but the rise of these kind of private phenomena makes a huge difference. We see the rise of private police forces, and part of that goes back to what we were saying before, which was that big government had failed and that people were looking for different kinds of solutions, and part of it also had to do with a prosperity that allowed people to privatize. And that was both healthy, because prosperity is good, but it was also dangerous because it meant that people were withdrawing from public space, from civic duty, from civic engagement, from the us, and going much more to the I. And again, that's one of the things that Ronald Reagan, for all his conservative rhetoric, didn't really deal with. And I call it the great conservative contradiction, the great conservative blind spot. Conservatives haven't acknowledged the degree to which their own addiction to consumerist capitalism undermined the traditionalism that they think they are worshiping.
And that's one of the tensions that still exists within the Republican Party today.
Absolutely. And that combined with, you know, another central tension, which is the what we call the libertarian-libertine tension, which is that, you know, on the one hand, the Republicans say they don't trust government, but on the other hand, they also say that they want government to sometimes micromanage very personal decisions about marriage, about sexuality, about sex. And how do you get around that contradiction? Is problematic. How do you encourage liberty and freedom and small government without it also degenerating it into libertinism and selfishness and indulgence? These are issues that neither the Republicans nor, frankly, the Democrats have fully resolved.
One of the other things you mentioned a moment ago when you were talking about the unions, that this was not just, a lot of this was not just an American phenomenon, that many of these trends were going on throughout the world, that what Ronald Reagan was doing when he took on the air traffic controllers had its parallels in what Margaret Thatcher was doing in the UK.
Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan have a wonderful relationship, and they really learn from each other and play off each other. The very short introduction that I wrote to The Reagan Revolution comes basically from a UK series that has 200 different short books about all kinds of different aspects of knowledge. Now they're sort of breaking into the American market. And one of the things that was interesting in writing that book was making sure that while writing it for the American market, I also was sensitive to the British market. And one of the things that I delved into was this whole remarkable relationship between Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. There was a personal chemistry. There was an ideological bond, both in that they came into their respective countries when government was bloated and they felt they needed to shrink government, they needed to go back to the power of the individual and the power of capitalism. And also, as I said at the very beginning, they also understood completely, in a way that few people did, how dangerous the Soviet Union was and how ultimately weakened it was by its corruption. And being able to strike that balance between taking it very seriously as a danger, but also understanding that if pushed enough, it just might collapse by itself, was one of the great gifts to world history of Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and we also have to include Pope John Paul in this holy trinity, really, of people who understood things that many others didn't.
Gil Troy, his books are Living in the 80s, which is a collection of wonderful essays about that period of time, and The Reagan Revolution, a very short introduction, both published by Oxford University Press. Gil, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, and they were great questions.
Thank
great
you.
Talking to you.